Okay, so hello. Just an announcement, tomorrow there will be an exercise on the last exercise sheet. And in the last lecture we looked about pipelining. So we looked at the fundamentals in pipelining, the operation principles, and we then came to the point of pipeline hazards, how the pipeline might get stalled. And we discussed first data dependencies, where we saw that true data dependencies can cause the pipeline to stall. We need to insert some pipeline bubbles, or we could use some things like forwarding or even compiler optimization to prevent this. And then we continued towards the control flow hazards, where the branch instruction, especially the conditional branches, caused the major problem here. And we discussed some classical techniques, like fast branch and jump logic, as well pipeline interlocking to prevent control flow hazards. And then the last thing we looked at, or we started to look at, was branch prediction, which is a state-of-the-art technique in today's microprocessors. And I would just to set in again on this point. So the idea on branch prediction is just that I try to predict the outcome of a branch, of a conditional branch, by previous outcomes of the branch. So if we would firstly assume a perfect branch predictor, we still would have a bubble of two pipeline slots, because if we have this perfect branch predictor in the instruction decode phase, then we know after the instruction decode that we have a branch, and due to the branch predictor we knew the outcome of the branch. Nevertheless, we still have to take the address of the branch, and we get the address of the branch in the after the operand fetch, so at that time we have the address of the branch, and then we can load the next correct instruction. So the major problem is that we detect a branch in the ID phase, in the instruction decode phase. And to prevent this, the idea was to introduce a branch target address cache, where we collect all the branch addresses, the addresses of all the branches we have, so we can identify a branch by its address. So we take parts of the memory address and take this as an index in our branch target address cache and see if we have an entry at that bits in our branch target address cache and if the address matches the branch address. And I explained this at the blackboard in more detail. And then we can find out even just in the instruction fetch phase that we have a branch, and we can as well directly get the target address where to branch from this branch target address cache. And having that, we really can reduce the penalty to zero clock cycles by, during the instruction fetch phase, we are looking at the address of the instruction we are fetching. We use this address as an index to the branch target address cache. From that index here, we first get the information, yes, this is a branch or not. And then we already get the next address. And then the only thing left to do is to find out, is a condition true or false, and the condition true or false is delivered by our still perfect branch predictor. So within a single clock cycle, we identify a branch as a branch, we determine the target address, and we determine the outcome of the branch, so we can directly load the next correct instruction. So this is the way it's done on up-to-date microprocessors, and so we have a penalty of zero cycles. Okay, and then we stated that we, of course, need two preconditions that this works. First of all, we must have the branch address stored in the branch target address cache. This should be true after a warm-up phase. Of course, in the warm-up phase, initially, the branch target address cache will be empty. And the branch prediction must be correct, and if not, we will get a penalty. And we as well calculated the penalty here. The penalty we get is given by the misprediction rate of a branch times the penalty for a misprediction, which might be quite large, for instance, 11 or so of a Pentium. We discussed last lecture about pipecoin pipeline length, and I was curious, and I tried to find out on up-to-date processor about more information on the pipeline length, and I have a list on up-to-date processor pipeline length at the end of this lecture, at the end of this slide. So you can see how long the pipeline for different processors today are. So for the Pentium 2, it would be 11. So we would have, for instance, a penalty of 11 clock cycles if we have a misprediction, and we would have to flush the entire pipeline. Or in case we have a correct prediction, we might even have a branch target address cache miss. And in that case, the penalty will be PB. In our example, this would be the two additional clock cycles we need to retrieve the correct address for the branch. And then we could calculate, or we were able to calculate, utilization of the pipeline, which usually would be N, but now we have N plus P, so we can calculate by N, which would be the optimal case, divided by N plus P, where P is the penalty. Yeah?
Also, this flash is here, has a dependent to the N,
right? Yeah. The problem is the refill of the pipeline. So flushing the pipeline means make it empty. So this is quite easy, make the pipeline empty, it's just discard all the stages, but then the pipeline is empty. Okay. And you have to start over from the beginning again, that's the problem. Okay, that led us to the conclusion we would need an excellent branch prediction. And we distinguished between static and dynamic branch prediction. While static branch prediction means at runtime, no change in the prediction. So the prediction is either directly implemented by hardware or given by the compiler. So we discussed as well four techniques. Predict always not taken, where we always assume the branch is not taken, which is the most simplest one, because we don't need even a branch target address cache. We don't need to estimate or get the address, because we just step on and later find out, okay, maybe it was wrong. A bit better is predict always taken. In that case, we need a branch target address cache to find out where to branch, because we always take the branch then. A quite good solution is the predict backward taken, forward not taken, which comes from loop estimation. So we assume that a backward branch is mostly a loop branch, and loops are usually run more than once. So the branch is taken quite often. So we predict a backward, we assume a backward taken branch is a branch of a loop, and this branch will be taken quite often during the loop. So we predict this taken. We assume further a forward branch doesn't belong to a loop, so it will be rarely taken. So we predict it as not taken. And we can improve this by compiler control, because here we assume that a backward branch is a branch which belongs to a loop and a forward not, but the compiler exactly knows. So if we provide a bit for each branch, then the compiler can tell, okay, this is a loop branch, so predict this branch as taken, or this is not a loop branch, so predict this branch as not taken. However, it's much more advantageous to use dynamic branch prediction. Dynamic branch prediction means that we, during runtime, investigate the history of a branch, and then provide our prediction according to this history. And so we store the history of the branch, taking some bits for that. And one quite simple solution is that we can use already available branch target address cache and extend our branch target address cache to as well store some history bits. So this is the idea. I have my extended branch target address cache. The index bits, which identify the address of the instruction fetched and by which we can identify it's a branch, the correct address of the branch, so they can see, okay, this is really a branch, the address of what we have currently taken, the target address where the branch leads, and then history bits, which tell us about the previous outcome of the branch. So what was the history of this branch? And this is the bits we use to make our decision if we predict the branch is taken or not taken. Okay, as well, we have to, of course, deal with interferences, because we only can use part of the address here, not the entire address. So there might be conflict. The two branches lead to the same entry because they share the same bits here. And then, of course, these two branches will mess up the history bit of the other one, so we will get a problem. So this will not lead to correct branch prediction. So the only solution here is, of course, to make the branch target address cache larger if we have this. Okay, and then that was the last slide we had in the last lecture. We started with a very first simple technique, which is a one-bit predictor. So the predictor just uses one single bit for each branch to store the history, and it's just the outcome of the previous branch. So we have the predictor is an initial state, let's say an initial state taken, And as long as a branch is taken, we stay in this state and predict the branch is taken. On the first wrong prediction, when we were first wrong, when we predict taken and the branch was not taken, we change our state. Now we predict the branch is not taken, and we do this as long as the branch is really not taken. And when we have the next misprediction, we change the state again. So in fact, we predict each outcome of a branch just like the previous outcome of this branch. So this is quite simple, since it takes only a single bit for each branch and allows already a quite high prediction success ratio in the predictions of about 70 to 80%. It's quite good. In fact, it can be improved, and the next improvement is a so-called two-bit predictor. In the two-bit predictor, we invest 2 bits to foretell the outcome of a branch. 2 bits mean we have 4 states, and these 4 states are predict strongly taken, predict weakly taken, predict weakly not taken, and predict strongly not taken. So we have now 2 states where we predict the branch is taken. In these 2 states, we predict the branch is taken. And in these 2 states, we predict the branch is not taken. Meaning, let's say, assume we start in the strongly taken state. We predict the branch is taken as long as the branch is taken. When the branch is not taken, we switch to the weak state, but still predict the branch is taken. If we are right, we go back to the strong state, but if we're wrong, then we go to the predict weakly not taken state, and the other way around. So this branch predictor, in this branch predictor, it needs 2 mispredictions to change our prediction. So if we are only have 1 misprediction, we do not change our prediction. And in fact, there are 2 possible implementations of this branch predictor. This is the 2-bit predictor with saturation counter. Saturation counter comes from that we just have a counter here. So we have 00, 01, 10, 11 for the bits. So in fact, this is a counter. So going from here to here, we count up until we reach the saturation state, 11, and then we stay there. And the other way, we count down until we reach the saturation state. So it's quite easy to implement using a counter, a 2-bit counter, saturation counter, where we just saturation means in a non-saturation counter, it would go from 11 again to 00 on the next clock cycle. So this would be not a saturation counter. On a saturation counter, we stay in the extreme states. This is the most simplest implementation of the 2-bit predictor. Not the most effective one. A bit better performs the 2-bit predictor with just a hysteresis counter. It's the same. We have the same 4 states. We have a strong state and a weak state for each taken and not taken. Strong state, we say in both states we predict the branch is taken or predict the branch is not taken if we're here. As well, when we assume we are in the strongly taken state and we have a misprediction, so the branch was not taken, we go as well as previously. We go to the We go to the weak state like here, so there's no change. But the change comes if we are again wrong. So if we have 2 mispredictions, the saturation counter now goes to the weak state of the other prediction. Here we go to the strong state of the other prediction. So if we have two wrong prediction, we change to the weak state to the strong state of the other prediction direction. So in fact, if we have two mispredictions, we change our prediction, then it takes again 2 mispredictions to change it back. In the other way, it would take only 1 misprediction to change our mind again. So here, let's assume here we are here, then we made a wrong prediction, so we end up here, still predict the branch is taken, then we make another wrong prediction, we end up here, predict the branch is not taken, but if we then have again a misprediction, we go back to the weak state and predict the branch is taken again. So it takes only then 1 misprediction after changing our mind to change our mind again. Here, it takes 2 mispredictions to change our mind again. So we are here, first misprediction, we end here. Second misprediction, we change our mind and here, and then it takes again 2 mispredictions to change our mind back. So this is the hysteresis counter, behaves a bit more stable and proves a bit better results than the saturation counter. basic question. What are the major advantages of a two-bit predictor compared to the one-bit predictor? Why these two states? And this has quite a simple explanation. And the simple explanation are nested loops, which occur very often. They will show you on the blackboard what happens. Let's assume we have a nested loop. So we have an inner loop. And within this inner loop, we have outside this inner loop, we have an outer loop. Okay. Now look what happens if we have a one-bit predictor. We are looking at this branch here in the inner loop. This is the branch we are examining currently. So, okay, we enter the loop. We come to this branch for the first time. We don't know what happened. It depends on the state of the one-bit predictor. Either the predictor is right or the predictor is wrong. However, the branch will be taken, so the predictor now goes to the taken state and predicts taken, predicts the branch is taken. And as long as we are in the inner loop, this prediction now is correct. The next misprediction comes when we leave the inner loop. No predictor at all would be able to predict this except he would know the loop counter. So we have one misprediction here when we are leaving the inner loop. So we can count, we have one misprediction here. Let's assume at the initial we would have been right. So we have one misprediction of the one-bit predictor. And now the predictor changes its prediction to not taken because we had the misprediction. Now the state is not taken and we have left the inner loop. Now we come to the outer loop, and from the outer loop we go back to the inner loop again. Then on the first run of the inner loop we come back to this branch, and now the state is not taken, so the predictor would predict this branch is not taken, but this is quite probably wrong because we run again the inner loop, so now we would have the second mistake. Now the predictor would be again in the state taken. What happens if we use a two-bit predictor? Okay, again, when we run for the first time, we come to the inner loop. We don't know what happens. So assume the predictor would be right, like in the first case. Then we run through the loop. The predictor would be in the state strongly taken while processing the loop, and this is and would predict the outcome of the loop correctly as long as we are in the loop. Now we leave the loop. So we have again. So this is one-bit predictor. We had two mispredictions. Now we look at the two-bit predictor. Now, like the one-bit predictor, of course, the two-bit predictor makes a misprediction here because it's in the strongly taken state, but the branch is not taken because we are leaving a loop. So we'll have one misprediction here. Then, again, we enter the outer loop, come back to the inner loop, and now we process the inner loop. I have to say, we now hear from, we change by this misprediction, the two-bit predictor changes its state from the strongly taken to the weakly taken state. We come back from the outer loop to the inner loop. Now we come back to this branch, and now, well, the one-bit predictor made his mistake because it changed his mind here. The two-bit predictor is still in the taken state, in the weakly taken state, but still in the taken state, so the two-bit predictor will predict this branch as taken and will not make a mistake. So in a nested loop, on every re-entry of the inner loop, the two-bit predictor makes two mistakes, leaving the inner loop and re-entering the inner loop, while the two-bit predictor makes only one mistake, leaving the inner loop, but does not make a mistake on re-entering the inner loop. So that's as well what's written here on the slide. I have this inner loop, the outer loop. The one-bit predictor mispredicts when leaving the inner loop and mispredicts when re-entering the inner loop, while the two-bit predictor only mispredicts when leaving the inner loop but does not make a misprediction when leaving the outer loop. Okay, this is a major advantage of the two-bit predictor, and since nested loops are quite common in software, the two-bit predictor in fact is superior to the one-bit predictor and does not take much more effort to be implemented. Okay, now I would be able to exploit these techniques to have a 3-bit predictor or 4-bit predictor, but if you do practical experimentation, you see that having more than 2 bits doesn't really pay. So a 3-bit predictor, of course, would then be able to have more than nested loops and so on, but this is not so often, doesn't happen so often that it really pays. So just practical evaluation showed that 2-bit predictor is quite an optimum ratio between overhead, which I get through to memory needs, and efficiency. So the 2-bit predictor has turned out to be a quite very well standard predictor. So most of the predictors used today are 2-bit predictors. Okay, however, there is more room for improvement on prediction, because the 1-bit predictor, like the 2-bit predictor, or even the n-bit predictor, just looks at the history of a single branch. But in many cases, branches are not independent of each other. So look at this simple code example here. So we have a code, we decrement our accumulator register, and then we branch if the accumulator register, if this decrement produces a 0, this arithmetic operation, we branch to the label X, and then on the label X we do some other operation, then we branch if the 0 flag again is set to the label Y. So you see, these two branches are not independent, because when this branch is taken as well. If this branch is not taken, I don't know what happened with the other branch, but if this branch is taken, I really know that this branch will be taken as well. So, and this happens often in code, that branches are correlated to each other. So one branch is always taken if another branch is as well always taken. And this is something which is not exploited by 1 or 2-bit predictors. So this correlation between branches is not respected here, and this leads us to the next improvement, which are called the so-called correlation predictors. And the correlation predictors now try to exploit this feature. So while the 1-bit predictor only exploits the self history of the branch, the correlation predictor as well uses the neighbor history, so it as well uses the history of the neighbored branches. What by meaning neighbored branches does not mean the branches are neighbored like the code is written, but in the execution sequence, neighbored in the execution sequence. So let's make an example. I have here something like that. I have a branch here, a branch here there. Then I make another branch here. Then of course this branch and this branch are neighbored branches, regardless how many branches are here in between, because they are not taken. It's just the branches in the sequence of the execution, the branches according to the broken trace. This is what's meant here with neighbored. So, and this means the own history and the history of the neighbored in execution order preceding branches is used. And then we can make a notation, what you call an MN predictor, where the MN predictor uses the history of the last M branches, of the last M neighbors, and uses therefore to predict them an N-bit predictor. To make this a bit more clear, let's assume we exploit the neighbor history of the last 3 branches. So we take 3 branches, and then what we have is, in fact, we can store the history of 3 branches in the 3-bit register. We can say, okay, let's say 0, 0, 0 means all the last 3 branches have not been taken. Or we can have 1, 0, 0, which means, okay, directly preceding branch has been taken, but the other 2 branches a bit farther away have not been taken. Or we can have something like that, or something like that here, which means the last 2 branches have been taken in our history. So we can, if we want to evaluate the history of the last 3 branches, we can use a 3-bit register. For the last M branches, we use an M-bit register. And of course, we can use a shift register for that, because then the next actual branch comes. So this, let's assume this is our current history of the branches, and then the next actual branch comes, so the next actual branch will be taken. Then now this is our new history, or not taken, then this will be in the new history. So in fact this is a shift register, a 3-bit shift register. The oldest branch is shifted out on the right side, the newest branch is shifted in on the left side. So I have always, in case of using the last 3 branches, a 3-bit shift register, in case of having M branches, an M-bit shift register. And this register is called the branch history register. The HT, the branch history, HR register. We come to the branch history table as well as the branch history register one step before. As already you see, if we have three bits, of course, we have eight possible histories. 2^3 is 8, so we have 8 possible histories. Having m bits, we have 2^m possible histories. And this is what the MN predictor does. The MN predictor uses the bit pattern of the last m branches to select one 2-bit predictor or one n-bit predictor here. So that's the basic idea. And so an MN predictor uses the last m branch to select one of possible 2^m predictors, which each of these predictors is an n-bit predictor for the single given branch. So the difference is that now for a given branch I not have only one n-bit predictor, but I have 2^m n-bit predictors, and each of these predictors is responsible for a certain history. So let's assume again an example having a 2-bit predictor would mean I not have for a given branch a single 2-bit predictor, but I would have 8 2-bit predictors for a branch, each for any combination of the previous three branches here. So of course this produces more overhead, and but it allows now to as well use the neighbor history. So we use the branch history register as an m-bit shift register to indicate the history, and this register is used as an index to our pattern history table, and the pattern history table contains the predictors themselves. So I have here another example using a 2-2 predictor, which means I have 2 bits again, and now I use a 2-bit shift register. So now I have a table. I have a, of course, the branch itself, the branch address, which now selects the predictor, but the branch address not only selects a single predictor like before, which would be a single predictor for this branch. So having just one of these tables would be just before n-bit predictor, so each branch has its predictor. But we have as well the branch history register as another index to the table, and now it selects one of these tables. So the real predictor used in that case would be that one, which means this predictor is selected by the branch address and by the branch history register. So, and this is what we call the pattern history table. A pattern history table is a table of many, many n-bit predictors, and is indexed by the branch itself, by the branch address, and by the branch history. So in fact, you can see if you make a slice here, these are all the predictors for a single branch, and these are all predictors for a single history. And together, you get this two-dimensional array here, which is called the pattern history table. And using this, you can not only exploit self-history, but as well neighbor history of the branch. It's quite interesting in research that sometimes independent groups have the same idea, same here. This correlation predictor were proposed nearly at the same time as the so-called two-level adaptive predictors in the year 1992 by Yale and Pat. And in fact, those two approaches are quite similar. Independent approaches, completely independently published, but they are quite similar. And the two-level adaptive predictors, in fact, use as well, like here, we have two levels. We have a history table and a branch history table and a pattern history. Use, in fact, the same approach, but it's a bit more common. Here, the branches are just categorized according to 9 possible possibilities we have. Let's first look at our branch history register. So we introduced the branch history register in the previous approach, where we select choose the history of a branch. And in the correlation predictor, there is one branch history register, which always uses a shift register, which always uses the history of the last branches. This means I have a global branch history register. So all the branches share the same branch history register. Now I can come to the idea, okay, why not give each branch its individual branch history register? Not so each branch has its own branch history register, which is selected by the branch address. leading not to a single branch history register, but to a branch history table, each branch individually. And since in most cases, it's of course not possible to use the entire branch address, but I have to restrict it to some of the branch bits, then I come to a passet scheme where I just use some bits of the branch as a selector to a branch history register. So I not only have a single branch history register like here, which has a bit the risk that if I have some kind of concurring, if I have two branches which produce some kind of concurring history, they mess up in a single branch history register. If I have two branch history registers, they are isolated, so they don't mess up each other. So it makes it definitely better. And the same I can do for my pattern history table. Here in the previous approach, I have a pattern history table which is indexed by the branch address. So each branch has its individual entry in the pattern history table. But as well, I can question this and can do the same here. I can even have, say, I have one global pattern history table. So the branch address does not care. I just each branch shares the same pattern history table. Or each branch has its individual entry in the pattern history table. Or I use part of the bits of the branch to select the pattern history table. And I can combine this. And I have, in fact, overall 9 combinations. And they are classified by some letters. So the uppercase letter G for global, P for per address, and S for set for the branch history register. And the lowercase G, S, and P for the pattern history table leads me to classification like GAG, GAS, PAS, SAP. If I compare the approaches, the previous approach here, with that approach, it turns out that the correlation predictors, in fact, are these two subclasses here. So in the correlation predictor, I have a global branch history register. See here, I have a global branch history register. And the branch address is either used entirely to index in my pattern history table, or at least parts of the bits are used. So in fact, the correlation predictor is a subgroup of the two-level adaptive predictors. So the two-level adaptive predictor is a more common approach, completely published independently. And I can show you some examples on that. So here are several examples of two-level adaptive predictors I have here. If you look at the upper left here, we have the simplest one, the GAG4, which means I have a global branch history register, a global pattern history table, and I use the last 4 branches in my history. This means in that predictor, the branch address doesn't care at all. So I don't look at the branch address. I just have my branch history register having the history of the last 4 branches from the branch I'm now. And I take this as an index into my pattern history table as well. The branch address doesn't care anyway, so the branch address doesn't matter here. And I take here, for instance, the 2-bit predictor, and then say, okay, 2-bit predictor is in a strongly taken state, so I predict this branch is taken. Now I can extend this to the GAP. The GAP, which is in fact the correlation predictor we had before, where still I have a single branch history register for all branches, but then the branch address cares here. So the branch address is used as an index. So in fact, each branch has its individual part of the table, and the branch history register is an index. And for instance, for this branch here, with this history, we take that and re-predict taken. And let's assume here, for another branch, you might have here 0, 0. So if with the same history, we enter another branch, we would predict it as not taken. So in fact, while in this approach, for a given history, the branch is always predicted in the same way. Here, for a given history, the branch can be predicted in different ways depending on the branch itself. Okay, we can do it the other way around. Having now here a PAG predictor, where we have now not a single branch history register, but we have a branch history table, meaning the branch address now index is an index, and for each branch I have a different branch history register. So for this branch, my history would be 1100, and okay, for this branch, to make it a better example, change it here to the 1, then this one maybe would index to this branch. So in fact, for different branches, I might have different histories. But for the n-bit predictor itself, in that case, the 2-bit predictor, the branch address doesn't care. So only the index given by the branch history table selects a predictor, and the branch address is only takes inference only here in the history, but not in the table itself. And then, of course, I can use the most sophisticated version, which is PAP, where I have each branch has its individual branch history its individual entry in the branch history table, so its individual branch history register, so the branch address counts here. And this is used as an index, but as well here, each branch has its individual entry, so as well the branch address is used here. So that each branch has its individual history and has its individual predictor. So this is the most advanced and the most, of course, as well, a most expensive technology. And of course, I have here used the P variant, which means the per address. This assumes that the complete branch address is used as index, which is normally not realizable. So usually you would have the SS variant, so a SAG or SAS or something like that, where you not use the entire branch address, but a subset of the bits of the branch address to select the branch, which of course will then, of course, lead to interferences. But you see here, this is these are possible two-level adaptive predictors, and where we have the correlation predictors here as a subset of the two-level adaptive predictors. Okay, as well, quite famous predictors and well-used predictors, for instance, in the pension process series, are the G-share and the G-select predictors. And the G-share and the G-select predictors are two different techniques. If I have a global pattern history table, but I want to use the branch address as well as the branch history register as an index in the table to combine these two. So in fact, I have the problem. Now I don't have individual pattern history tables for each branch. I just want to have one big pattern history table. And I want to calculate the index. And for the index, I want to use the branch history register as well as the branch address. And I want to combine these two in a way to form a quite good index to my table. So this is the idea. And there are two major possibilities to do that, which has become to know as the G-select predictor and the G-share predictor. The G-select predictor, in fact, concatenates bits. So it takes part of the bits of the branch history register, and it takes part of the bits of the branch address, and then just concatenates them, puts them together to one. While the G-share predictor as well takes part of the bits here, part of the bits there, and then does an XOR operation, does an exclusive OR operation to this. And if you see, it's quite an example, the G-share performs a bit better because it produces less interferences. And I have here an example. Let's assume we have a 8-bit branch address and an 8-bit branch history register, and we want an 8-bit index combined from those. If we are using a G-select, what we can do is we can take, for a G-select, the lower, for instance, the lower 4 bits from here, and the lower 4 bits from here, and then concatenate them. Meaning we have on that side here 0000, and we concatenate it with 1000, resulting in 1000000. So this is as well. So here, just how this is combined. You have that part. That part, this one goes here, and that one goes here. Well, these bits are the upper 4 bits, and these 4 bits are the lower 4 bits. Same for this. If we have this combination, we have the upper 4 bits are here, the lower 4 bits here. If we have this combination, the upper 4 bits here, the lower 4 bits here, and this combination, the upper 4 bits here, the lower 4 bits here. And you see, if we're using the G-select 4-4, we have here interference. Since these two outcomes are identical, even so we have different patterns, because the difference lies here and this is not regarded. So these two would produce the same result. If you look at the G-share 8-8, where we take the entire 8 bits of here and do an exclusive OR operation with the entire 8 bits of here, the outcome are as well 8 bits. And if I do an exclusive OR from here with here, so you see we have a all the bits are 0 to 0 is 0, 0 to 0 is 0, and so on. 0 to 1 is 1, so we end up with this pattern. If we have here all that's the same, then we end up, of course, with a 0-0 pattern. In that case, all the bits here are different. 1-0, 1-0, 1-0, so we end up with a 1-1-1-1 pattern. And here, all the bits are different except the first one. So the first bits are identical, means we have here the 0. All the other bits are different, we have the 1. So we end up with this pattern. You see here in this example, all the four patterns are different. So in fact, while the G-select would produce interference between these two branches combined with this history, the G-share would not. So, of course, there are other conditions where the G-select would perform better than the G-share, but overall, the G-share performs a bit better than the G-select due to less interferences. Okay, now, next step, what you can do is you can introduce hybrid predictors. Hybrid predictors means I not have one predictor, but I have two different predictors, and I have a third decision predictor. So, I have here predictor 1, I have predictor 2. Each of these two have an outcome. This one says branch taken, this one says branch not taken. And then, in case these two predictors produce a different result, I have a decision predictor, which then tells me which of these predictors I can trust more. So this is the next level. Now you can come to the conclusion, okay, are they crazy doing such a thing? But there is a real background because why this is quite useful. As more sophisticated a predictor gets, as more warm-up time the predictor needs. Let's assume I have such a predictor using all using a branch history table, a pattern history table, large tables. Initially these tables are empty. So the predictor will perform quite poor, really poor. On the other hand, assume a simple one-bit predictor, even a static branch prediction, which already at the beginning produces quite reasonable results. And this is one application where you use such a hybrid predictor, take a quite simple predictor during the warm-up phase and a quite sophisticated predictor once the system has been warmed up. And the decision predictor just predicts according to, okay, if in the beginning of our process, beginning of working, I take the more simple predictor as the more trustworthy, and if the system has warmed up, I take the more sophisticated predictor to be more trustworthy. So this makes really sense to do that. So a hybrid predictor then, just to summarize, consists of two different branch predictors and a selection predictor, which just chooses one of the two branches. And of course I can use any other predictor I know as a selection predictor. And example are the so-called McFarlane predictor, which just combines a quite simple two-bit predictor with a G-share predictor, or the Young and Smith predictor, which combines a compiler-controlled static predictor with a two-level adaptive predictor. And you see here as well, I usually have a simple predictor and a more sophisticated predictor, and this is just the idea that a simple predictor produces reasonable results in the warm-up phase, while the sophisticated predictor delivers better results later. And so you can combine this. You get usually better results than the individuals. And this is quite astonishing. So I have here an example. Different applications from benchmarks. So I have here compressed GNU compiler, Perl compiler, the game of Go, a simulator of a microprocessor, a Lisp, a water generator, and a JPEG system. And here you see how many instructions are committed. So here this one is 80 million instructions. 250 million instructions and so on. how many conditional branches. So we have 80 million instructions, where 40 million of these 80 million were conditional branches. Here we had 250 million instructions with 50 million of them conditional branches. Overall, in the mean of this, we had about 260 million instructions, where 46 of them were conditional branches. So conditional branches are not rare. They are quite often in a program. So this is 20% or so. 20% of the program instructions are conditional branches usually. Then the percentages of the taken branches, this is somehow ranges from 54%, 49%, 52%, here 71% in the simulator, quite many taken branches. In the average, 54% of the branches have been taken, of the conditional branches, because the 46 have been not taken. And then we have the misprediction rate of two predictors. I use a G-share on one side and a SAG on the other side. So SAG, just to call it up again, SAG would be, I have a SAG, I have here this combination, but with a S. So I take a part of the branch address to index my branch history table, and then I have a global pattern history table for all of this. So this is a SAG, just using parts of the branch address. And this one has been combined with the G-share. And here you see the misprediction rate of the individuals. For instance, for the compress, the SAG produced about 10%, the G-share as well about 10%. On the GNU compiler, the SAG 12% misprediction, the G-share 24% misprediction, and so on. Overall, the SAG produced 8.6% misprediction, while the G-share produced 14.5% misprediction. And combining these with the hybrid predictor, I end up with 8.1%. So combining these two predictors really pays. And you see in each case, there is an improvement. Well, here it's just the same, but for all other cases, we have an improvement by just combining these two predictors. And in none of the cases, there was a deteriorating. So always an improvement. So it really pays having these hybrid predictors, just combining two predictors and have a decision predictor on that. Okay, just some other crazy ideas. In case of branch prediction, since hardware is cheap, why not building a processor which is able to follow different branch directions at the same time? So it's just a simple example. This is a processor with a duplicated fetch stage. So once we fetch a branch, in the next stage we fetch two cycles. So we fetch in one part of the pipeline, we fetch the instructions for the branch being taken, and the other part of the pipeline we fetch the instruction for the branch not being taken at the same time. And then, of course, we have somewhere an issue point where we now have to decide, but we can delay our decision. And when we come to the point of decision, we then know which one of the branches has been taken, which one has not been taken, and we discard the rest. This sounds quite convincing. The problem is a bit if we have some kind of branches, nested branch, in the way that I have a branch, and then the next branch comes while the previous branch has not been resolved yet, and the next branch and so on, of course, the overhead increases in a geometric order. So, in fact, you can implement that, and it works as well. The problem is a bit the overhead you get and the efficiency. So these I just know processors from research doing that. I don't know any single industrial processor using that technique. However, it's a quite interesting idea, and of course, it's feasible. You can do that. It's called multipath execution. Okay, there is another possibility, which is called predication. Don't confuse prediction and predication. Two completely different things. Quite close from the word, but completely different. Predication means I can make the execution of an instruction dependent on a predicate. So I have conditional execution of instructions. an instruction. So I can have a instruction. Let's call this instruction. For instance, let's take an add instruction. And then I can attach a predicate on this instruction, something like p.add, which means only if the predicate p is true, the instruction add is executed. If the predicate p is false, the instruction is ignored. So this is what I call predication. Only if the predicate is true, the instruction is executed. And there exist processors where all instructions, the entire instruction set, is predicated, which means each type of instruction can be attached to the predicate bit. And if you have this, I'm talking about a fully predicated instruction set. And for example, the ARM processor has a fully predicated instruction set. Or I can, in an ARM processor, I can make each instruction dependent from a predicate, and the Itanium as well. And the idea of these predicates is to avoid conditional branches completely. Okay, here's an example. We have a compare instruction, and depending on the compare instruction, we do a branch. If the compare is true, so if A is 0, we branch to L1 and continue with this. Otherwise, we do the add instruction, the sub instruction, then we are here. This is the realization with conditional branch. Using predication, we can do it that way. We do a compare R0, A to 0, and store the outcome in the predicate bit P. And then the next two instructions we just make dependent from this predicate bit. So only if the predicate bit P is true, these two instructions are executed. And then here, this is an unpredicated instruction again. So in fact, these two pieces of code do exactly the same thing. While having here a conditional branch, and while having here no conditional branch at all. So predication means I can avoid any conditional branches. Yeah? This is another problem, of course. You have to wait a bit to evaluate the predicate. However, you can avoid branch prediction. that's a major point. Now the question is another question.
If the avoided branches, conditional instructions are very much, we still have to fetch and decode all the instructions.
Yeah, that's. I'm just coming to this point here. The question is obviously, since with predication I can obviously completely avoid conditional branches, why not all our processors are predicated? Why are we talking about conditional branches at all? And this is for some reasons, of course. One problem is, as he mentioned, it's not only that I have to fetch these predicate instructions and decode them. Usually in a standard processor they are even executed. But just the result is not written back. So just in the write-back phase, these are ignored. So they produce hardware effort. They produce energy consumption. And now, assume the following code. I just write it now. I write it in C. But if some condition is true, then 1,000,000 lines of code, else another 1,000,000 lines of code. Now assume using predication for that. You would execute 1,000,000 instructions in vain just for nothing before you come to the first valid instruction. So this would be tremendously ineffective. So while a conditional branch would be extremely effective here, just skipping all the code. So this is one major drawback, that I have an unnecessary execution of instructions, which can be really produce a large overhead. And another problem is, as soon as I attach predication bits to the instruction, I need more bits for the instruction, because I have somehow to code in an instruction that this is a predicated instruction, and from which predicate bit this instruction belongs. So I need more bits in the instruction format, and I want to keep my instruction format as small as possible. So these are the disadvantages. There are, of course, advantages because I can avoid conditional branches. I need no speculation. And another important thing is the so-called basic block length. In compiler optimization or code execution, I define a basic block. It's a piece of code between two branches. So a basic, if I branch from somewhere, then I execute some code, and then I branch to another address, then this between is what I call a basic block. And as longer basic blocks are, as more room is for optimization, and even as we will see in the next lecture, when we come to the next hour, if even more level of instruction level parallelism can be exploited there. So increasing the length of a basic block is quite advantageous, and this is something what I can reach using predication. So this is the reason why predication exists. ARM has it, Itanium has it, but of course it cannot completely avoid conditional branches. I need, in fact, both have it. Pros and cons. So there are some applications where conditional branches are much better, and there are some applications where predication is much better. But again, don't conflict predication with prediction. It's nearly the same word, but it means something completely different. Okay, there is another idea. In a realized first in an industrial processor in the Pentium 4, and this is so-called trace cache. Trace cache seen opposite to the instruction cache. In an instruction cache, the instructions are stored in the program order, like the programmer has written the instruction. In a trace cache, the instructions are stored in the execution order, how the instructions were executed. This is what I call a trace. So a trace is a sequence of executed instructions which can span several basic blocks. So like here, I come from here, then I branch to here, I go to here, I branch to another address. All this entirely would be a trace. Therefore, in a trace, I have already solved all branches. If I know a trace, I don't have any more branch. I know here, let's say I have here instruction add, then sub, subtract. Then I have my branch, my conditional branch. Then I have a multiply instruction here. So in fact, the trace would be add, sub, multiply. The branch is not part of the trace because the branch changes the trace. So the trace would be that. So in a trace, there is no more branch left. And now a trace cache stores such a trace while the trace is executed. And if the same trace is executed again, I don't have a single branch left. So I just can repeat the trace. Don't need to branch any longer. So while instruction cache contains a static instruction sequence where I have branches within, the trace cache contains dynamic instruction sequence where I already have these three blocks here fit together to one block. So in the trace cache, I don't need no longer branch prediction. What I need in that case is a next trace prediction then. If one trace ends, what would be the next trace to execute? Interestingly here, the trace cache has been proposed in research about 1998 or so in the first paper as an add-on to the instruction cache. So there was a hierarchy level instruction cache, and after the instruction cache, then the trace cache. Firstly, implemented was the trace cache in an industrial processor in the Pentium 4, completely avoiding the instruction cache. So the Pentium 4 only had a trace cache, no instruction cache at all. And no one in the research community thought about just having this in that way, but it works quite well. It's interesting. So the Pentium 4 doesn't have an instruction cache at all, just as a trace cache. Okay, as promised, I've tried to look up some pipeline lengths on contemporary processors. And as I already mentioned, on the Pentium 2, we have 11 stages from 1997. The Pentium, or it's Intel, not Intech, okay. The Pentium 4 differs, so the first version of the Pentium 4 had 20 pipeline stages, and the very last version of the Pentium 4 had 31 pipeline stages, so quite large. Then in the Intel Core technology, the Core 2 technology, the length of the pipeline was reduced to the problem. When the Pentium was developed, we still were with the development increasing clock frequencies, getting from 1 gigahertz to 2 gigahertz, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 gigahertz. And as more gigahertz you want to have, as more pipeline stages you need, because you want to have each part executed faster on a faster clock frequency. From a step from here to here, it turned out that we get significant thermal problems, increasing the clock frequency more on, which led to a reduction in the pipeline stages to 14 stages in the Core 2 processor technology, the net burst technology, what's the internal Intel name, making the pipeline shorter again, because we don't want to further increase the clock frequency, but having more focus on executing more instruction in parallel within one clock cycle. Interestingly, with the Netherlands microarchitecture implemented the Core i7, the pipeline length is increased again. So today's Core i7 have, depending on the implementation as well on what operations are performed, 20 to 24 stage pipelines. Not as long as Pentium 4, but again nearly double the size of the Core 2 length of the pipeline. I already looked at the IBM Power, and I found out for the Power 5 and the Power 6, the pipeline varies between 15 and 24 stages. 24 is a floating point version of the pipeline. 15 is an integer stage of the pipeline. And I really tried to find out the pipeline length of a Power 7, but actually I found no information on that. The only thing in some discussion forums, you find out, okay, it's not revealed yet. So they keep this disclosed currently. So actually, I found no information on the Power 7, and of course not on the Power 8. So I don't know about that. But you see that we have at least 10 to 20 pipeline stages, which seems to be a good compromise between speed improvement on one side and penalty in case of pipeline hazards, misprediction, and so on the other side. Okay, so this ends the section on pipelining. We'll just say, okay, make the break now, 5 minutes earlier, but okay, because then I come to the next chapter where we'll look at concurrency, which means superscalar, VLIW, EPIC, and so on. But this after the break.